Bienvenidos and welcome to the Jacobin Sports Show. I'm Matthew Miranda, regrettably solo this episode. Jonah Birch is at Boston Celtics training camp, hoping to replace the injured Danilo Gallinari as their best bench-scoring big. So we wish Jonah good luck and hope to see him playing in the NBA later this season. So it's just me today. I'm toughing out what was initially diagnosed as a bruised lung, but now appears to be instead a torn back muscle, and I don't know which is better. Torn back muscle, by the way, if you haven't tried it before, you're not missing out. Every time I cough, it feels like somebody with brass knuckles has just punched me like right in the back of my lung. So, but I'm here today. I'm toughing it out. Players play. And we have a lot to talk about. Haven't had an episode in a while, which doesn't mean there hasn't been content. If you are subscribed to the Jacobin Patreon, patreon.com/Jacobin Sports Show, there have been a couple of written pieces that have come out the last couple of weeks. If you feel like you're missing out, $5 a month is all it needs to get on the reading list. So check us out there, patreon.com/Jacobin Sports Show. One of the topics that we are going to be talking about today was what I wrote about for the Patreon yesterday, Serena Williams. We're also going to talk about Gilbert Arenas and some comments he made recently. The Bills, I don't know what to call it, the Bills, the Buffalo Bills' odd process with punter Matt Araiza. If you haven't heard about that story, you kind of have heard about it if you've ever followed the NFL off the field. We're going to talk about Barcelona football and where, you know, the rule of law just does not apply to the very rich. And I also want to talk a little bit about Duke volleyball, which was not expected, but something important happened last week in their game at BYU. So we'll talk about that as well. Please remember, you can also follow us on Twitter at Jacobin Sports Show. So let's get into things. First, I want to start with Serena Williams, because I think that's the biggest story in sports by far right now. Serena Williams, if you don't know, she recently lost at the US Open. It's just her final. She's apparently retiring after this tournament. Sometimes in sports, that doesn't really mean anything. But Serena says that she's retiring. And a few things that have come out of this. One is a bizarre post-career already kind of conflict where Margaret Court, if you follow tennis, or if you don't follow tennis, actually, Margaret Court played a long time ago. She played before what is now known as the Open era. So Margaret Court was dominating women's tennis, but dominated at a time where, like, there were conditions. So basically Margaret Court complained that she doesn't think Serena Williams admires her the way that Court admires Serena. And Court also feels that her accomplishments have been minimized in light of, you know, Serena and the moment and all the marketing that goes with it and all the media attention that goes with it. I can't remember his name now. Someone on Twitter today had a really excellent thread. I wish I could find it, about all the reasons why Serena is not to be compared to Margaret Court, that it's unfair to Serena even to compare them. What's interesting to me about the story, first of all, is Margaret Court feeling like left out after all these years. Maybe, I don't know if she has been honored as she feels she should be. She won. So Margaret Court has won 24 open. She's won like 24. I can't remember how the terminology goes. Serena's won 23, I think, Grand Slams, and Court won 24, but they weren't all Grand Slams the way they are now. For example, the Australian Open wasn't open, really, to people outside of Australia. It didn't really become a major until the 1980s. Up to that point, it basically was Australians. There were some tournaments that Court won that count toward her total, where her opponent either just was injured and couldn't play, or sometimes she was beating amateurs. It sounds like Margaret Court has a bit of a George Mike and Wilt Chamberlain thing going on, where like she clearly was the dominant player of her time, but she wasn't playing against the caliber of people. Like, it wasn't professionalized the way it is now with Serena. So we don't need to dump on Margaret Court to praise Serena, but Margaret Court seems to feel that she has been dumped on. And I think Serena defenders have a fair case to make, pointing out that you don't need to slander Margaret Court, but it's very hard to, like, you can't really argue George Mikan was better than Shaq. You just can't. Same thing, I think, here. And it doesn't diminish Court was the dominant player of her era. These GOAT comparisons sometimes get tricky because we can't line up everything. You can't even really compare LeBron James and Michael Jordan, who missed each other in the NBA by one season. So how do you compare Serena Williams and Margaret Court? In any event, the greater, I think, topic around Serena is the end of the athletic career of someone that I consider the greatest athlete that I've ever seen. In terms of from start of their career to the end, I didn't see Michael Jordan's first half of his career. I never saw Wayne Gretzky until really the last half of his career. Of people that I have seen in sports, the greatest athletes that I have seen from start to finish, you're talking LeBron James, maybe Randy Moss is up there, Bo Jackson, that kind of, but Serena Williams. So I wrote about this in the piece for the Patreon today. I was not, I crawled under the couch the other night and Serena was playing against the number two player in the world. Her name is Annette. Oh boy, it starts with a K, I think. She's playing the number two ranked player in the world. And as soon as I realized it's Serena playing at the US Open, and this is her last tournament, I sat there and watched the whole thing. I don't watch every... I like tennis. I tend to watch either good head-to-head matchups or when they get farther into an open, I'll watch it. But I'm not usually watching, you know, first round, second round. Serena was... I was not leaving the couch. And my mother, who doesn't follow tennis at all, was sitting next to me watching it all. And I think it's a testament to... I mean, this is an athlete who has been dominant. Dominant, ahead of her time, ahead of her field, ahead of everything, for 25 years. Serena Williams, the first tournament she won was in November of 1997. In November of 1997, I was a sophomore in college. Now I'm teaching sophomores in college, and Serena Williams was still playing. And it's just been, for 25 years, I don't think anyone's been better. I don't think I've ever seen Serena Williams go into a match and thought, well, she's the underdog. I don't think I've ever thought that once. Maybe very early when she played Venus, her sister, just because Venus was a little bit older. But Serena has had the title of world's greatest tennis player for as long as I can remember. It didn't matter if she was out injured. You know, she had a C-section. She came back and won from that. She won, I think, a Grand Slam when she was 8 weeks pregnant. Someone in the Washington Post, Sally Jenkins, I think is her name, had a really great lead over the weekend that was saying, like, you know, who's the greatest athlete, you know, ever? Tom Brady, question mark. Like, he never had a C-section, and he didn't. And I think this is where the language of sports and language of GOAT conversations will hopefully evolve more this century as women's sports, I think, becomes more and more mainstreamed. There's really no exceptionality that you can apply here. Like, Tom Brady is maybe the best quarterback that I've seen, and LeBron James is maybe the greatest basketball player that I've seen. But to some extent, their success and their legacy is contingent on what their teammates do. It doesn't matter how good, you know, if Kyrie Irving isn't also amazing, then the Cavs don't beat the Warriors in 2016, and LeBron's defining accomplishment never occurs. Who knows how that changes his legacy? Tom Brady plays basically 20 years with a man regarded as the greatest coach ever in Bill Belichick in the NFL. If Tom Brady had had Rich Kotite or, you know, some coach that you haven't heard of because they stink, is he still Tom Brady? We don't know. If he has an offensive line that can't protect him, so he gets knocked around his first few years like Sam Darnold, is he still Tom Brady? Maybe. maybe that greatness like always rises, but for Serena in an individual sport to be completely dependent on herself and her dedication and her skill and her drive for improvement. And, you know, she could have, and this happens a lot in tennis. There are so many points Serena Williams could have stopped caring and said, okay, I've won every Grand Slam. Now I want to become a media figure, or now I want to go into having my own fashion line, or go into one of a million other things. And she just kept winning and winning and winning. She's not she's not perfect, particularly earlier in her career. Sometimes I was turned off by the number of times where Serena would lose a match and then suddenly announce some injury that no one had heard of or known about before. I thought that was a weak look. It might be true, I don't know. But it just looked like excuse making. But other than that's the other remarkable thing about Serena. And one of the things that was fascinating about her last couple of matches, Tiger Woods was in attendance cheering her on. Tiger Woods was supposed to be Serena Williams. Tiger Woods was supposed to be the athlete in 2022 that was not only chasing history, but probably done in making their own history. And that we would look back on and talk about, after Jordan, this person was the greatest athlete. But Tiger Woods shows you how difficult it is to reach that level and sustain it. Tiger Woods, when his fall began, that wasn't the same Tiger Woods that came up trying to make it big. Tiger Woods who fell, he had the house, he had the rep, he had the money, he already had the accomplishments, he had the family, he had all these things. And I am guessing, this is total speculation, but I'm guessing that the Tiger Woods behavior around the guy who crashed on Thanksgiving and never had his career be the same, I don't think Tiger Woods at 19, 20, 22 would have still made those decisions. Because I think there was a point in time when Tiger Woods wanted to rise to the top and stay there no matter what. And I think in a very, probably the most human thing about Woods, there's a point where when you're at the top and you've been there a while, it's easy to, maybe I care more about this, or maybe I want to get into that. That never happened with Serena Williams. During her quarter century of brilliance, she got married. She had a child. I think she has launched some of her own lines of fashion and stuff. She's done all that. But nevertheless, she's the dominant athlete of really this century so far. There's no one I think you can put ahead of her. So it'll be sad to see her leave. I think it will be interesting to see how tennis does in her absence. Because I'm not sure how much it has grown beyond Serena as a mainstream sport. I think, just like with Jordan in basketball back in the day, I think a lot of people are interested in Serena who are not generally interested in tennis as much. We'll see in the next few years how that turns out. But much respect to Serena Williams. Hope she enjoys her retirement. And it really has been awesome to watch her, just enjoy her play, and enjoy her consistency and endurance over 25 years. Another emerging kind of long-running narrative along the lines of Serena's dominance. For some reason in the NBA, there seems to be an obsession for current and retired players to try to tear down Giannis Antetokounmpo. If you didn't see this, Gilbert Arenas was on a podcast, and he was basically talking about how Giannis is not really even that talented, that Giannis is just big. We've heard this before. James Harden a couple of years ago complained that, if he was, Giannis's size, he wouldn't need to be skilled either. And this kind of crap goes back almost always against big men. Shaq heard it when he came into the league. It was never fair then either. Will Chamberlain going way back in time, and George Mikan. Even in the NBA, there's always been criticism that, you're big, whatever. If you're big, you don't need to be talented. I don't understand where this comes from. Giannis Antetokounmpo has been as good a player as there is in basketball now for years. He is not the best shooter, but he's improved as a shooter. I don't understand criticisms of that, because it's like when Shaq played, nobody criticized that Shaq didn't take more jumpers or more three-pointers, because if Shaq can just pretty much get the ball down low every time and score or force a foul, why does he need to change what he's doing? If you can't stop what he's doing and he's doing the same thing over and over again, the problem is not on Shaq. When Allen Iverson played, nobody said, well, he doesn't dunk enough or he doesn't post up enough, because that wasn't his strength, but he didn't need to do that. He was so quick and so relentless that he didn't need to do those things to be a Hall of Fame player. Giannis Antetokounmpo is not near the level of shooter that Steph Curry is or Kevin Durant is or even Gilbert Arenas was, but he doesn't need to be. I don't know why. I think it's partly because he's an international player. He didn't grow up in this culture. And also because Giannis has made it a point not to really fraternize with his rivals. So in all seasons, you know, LeBron has worked out with, I think, Durant before. And, you know, on dream teams, these players will get together and they'll buddy up. And Giannis has been invited to work out with other stars and turned it down, because he's a bit more of an old school competitor, and that he wants to win. He's very parochial. He loves his team. He loves his city. He's not interested in really anything besides being the best that he can be and testing it out. Gilbert Arenas has no grounds to be criticizing Giannis on. And it's a sad... I wrote about this two articles ago on the Patreon about what Howard Cosell called the jockocracy, which was his term in the 70s for former athletes becoming more and more a part of the broadcast world. And Cosell was really upset in that he thought these athletes, they were there, they weren't providing any insight, they weren't giving you any narrative, you know, perspective. They were just there because of their name and their resume. And sometimes you have an athlete who is really, really skillful and educational when you hear them talk about sports. Candace Parker has not been on Inside the NBA a lot, but when Candace Parker has been on Inside the NBA, she has brought more knowledge and insight to the audience than Shaq or Barkley or even Kenny Smith have, I think, the years that they've been there. Candace Parker is a great analyst. If you listen to Ron Darling or Keith Hernandez, former players, excellent calling the game. David Cohn in baseball the same way. Tony Romo gets a lot of crap, but he seems to me to be a very insightful NFL analyst. But Gilbert Arenas is kind of, I don't know why people still listen to Gilbert Arenas, which I guess I should count myself atop the list since I'm the one who brought him up. But Gilbert Arenas has kind of made a career post-retirement of just saying absurd things about the NBA, that if he was a dude, if you went to a bar and Gilbert Arenas was at the end of the bar saying the things that he has said, you would think he's a joke and would just tune him out. So I'm just surprised that there's still this anti-Giannis sentiment. And it's interesting to me, it's not the first time in the NBA that there is an obvious bias against an individual that I think is a surrogate for bias against a larger group of people. And depending who is doing the bias, it gets some attention or gets none. I'm not saying this is just, but as an example, a couple of years ago, there was a player, Myers Leonard, on the Miami Heat, who was playing a video game. I think he was on Twitch, and he said some anti-Semitic comments, and his career basically ended. He was dropped from his team in Miami. I don't think he's been able to catch on again with an NBA team. I don't mind. Doesn't bother me at all. But reaction was swift to that. Gilbert Arenas is not the first player to intimate that there is something fundamentally inferior about foreign players. It's odd that he's picking on Giannis of all of them, given that he's the best one and really the best player in the world, period. This happened years ago with Jeremy Lin, when Jeremy Lin had his great run with the Knicks, and then it was time for him to get a new contract. And when Lin got a better deal than people thought he would, Black athletes like Carmelo Anthony and J.R. Smith were vocal vocally condemnatory of Lynn getting the deal that he did, which if you follow sports, you know athletes almost never comment negatively about any money another athlete gets because it's seen as it's good for everybody. You know, if that guy got overpaid, great. Then the next one will get overpaid too. The reason I think it was okay for athletes to call out Jeremy Lin was because Jeremy Lin was Asian and they weren't used to seeing Asians get overpaid. They were used to seeing white guys get overpaid. They were used to seeing black guys get overpaid. They had never seen an Asian get overpaid. And it stuck with people the wrong way. So Gilbert Arenas, once again, showing us how not to be. Speaking of how not to be, out of the NFL this week, there was a disturbing story out of Buffalo where, this is a weird timeline, the Bills had a punter named Matt Araiza, A-R-A-I-Z-A, and he is a astonishingly powerful punter. His nickname is the Punt God. He kind of had a little cult following brewing up as just this incredible, incredible punter. And then it turned out that Araiza was named in a, I think now it's a civil lawsuit against three players in college accused of sexual assault and gang raping a high school girl who was underage at the time of the assault. Buffalo, the news came out, and as it turns out, Buffalo knew about the accusations before they made the decision to cut another punter and keep Araiza. And then once that story went public, after about 24 hours of dilly-dallying, then the Bills cut Araiza. I don't know if it's a question of when or if it's a question of never. I am so struck by football in particular seeming to make this same error in judgment over and over and over again. Right after Deshaun Watson, who's accused of sexually assaulting literally dozens of women, the fallout for Watson is he gets the largest contract at his position guaranteed in history. He's rewarded financially like no other player has been rewarded before. What is the message? How many times can the NFL show the public, we don't give a shit about ethics, power differentials, rape, sexual assault, misogyny? We don't care. He's a good quarterback. That's all that matters. They can shape it any way they want. The NFL appointed or worked to appoint the woman who initially suggested Watson's punishment should be, I think, a six-game suspension. And then to fly in and look like the good guys, the NFL then decided on its own that they would suspend Watson for 11 games and fine him $5 million. And on the page, that looks significant. No NFL player has been fined $5 million before. And 11 games is about 3/4 of the season. Well, now it's 17, so it's about 2/3 of the season. That's pretty big, right? But a $5 million fine means nothing to a man who just signed like a $230 million contract. It's like 2% of his, it's like 2% of just what he's going to make on the next deal. Deshaun Watson could be retired, and a $5 million fine wouldn't really touch him with everything that he's made. Now he's got $250 million coming to him literally on the heels of him settling sexual assault suits with dozens of people. And then the Araiza story breaks, and still, between the Bills and the NFL and Buffalo's coach and front office and the media, it still is a clown show. It's still, well, yeah, we heard about what he's charged with, but we're so confident in him, we're going to cut our candidate who has not been charged with sexual assault, and we're going to keep this guy. And then literally 24 hours later, oh, we've decided not to keep him. I don't know how popular the NFL actually is as far as a game. Somebody I read recently wrote a very interesting, and I think it was meant to be funny, but it was also true, how odd it is that when you really break down watching an NFL game, it's like a middle manager's dream. Like, it really is just meetings. The whole game is basically meetings. Huddles on both sides of the ball, huddles between the refs, huddles between players and refs, meetings between coaches and refs, meetings between coaches and players, meetings between media and players, media and coaches on the field. It's all meetings, 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 meetings. So I think the NFL's popularity is mostly because of gambling. I think if you took away fantasy sports and legalized gambling, their ratings would go way down. But I am curious, like, is the NFL, is it just scandal proof? Is there nothing that can happen in the NFL that is gross enough to turn people off? Because I always hear about how in 1994, when the Major League players went on strike, that they just lost some fans forever. Or it took baseball a long time in terms of attendance to get back to where they were. It doesn't seem like anything touches the NFL. I really think, you know, there could be a sexual assault, you know, tomorrow involving any NFL superstar you can think of. It won't make a difference. It won't touch anything, which is really disheartening. And the Bills actually tried to hold a press conference talking about it. It sounded nice if you hadn't already seen this a million times. But they had this press conference where basically like, look, you know, we're doing the best we can and we care about the things that they really wanted to paint themselves as like, hey, we're not like everyone else. We really think about this and feel this. But then their behavior was exactly the same. So grossness out of the NFL. Grossness of a very different kind and a different kind of football. Barcelona FC, the biggest soccer team in the world and therefore quite possibly the biggest sports franchise in the world. Barcelona has become a prime example of, you know, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Barcelona was about $500 billion in debt within the last year. That's, you didn't mishear me, $500 billion in debt. Generally, if a team is $500 billion in debt, I can't finish that sentence because it's never happened before. No team has ever been $500 billion in debt. Barcelona finds themselves there. You would think, all right, you have a team, it's in that's crazy amount of debt, and this is European football, which is regulated by FFP, the financial fair play stipulations and standards. They're supposed to exist to make sure that no team, in particular, to make sure it doesn't become a domino effect, but they're trying to protect against teams ending up in exactly this position, where Barcelona, certainly part of their debt was COVID related, but so was everybody's. But Barcelona, a year ago, embarrassingly, they can't, you know, Leo Messi wants to stay there. He's always played there. He's literally been in their organization since he was a kid. They want to keep him. They can't. They can't keep Messi because they literally don't have the money to bring him back. They have to let him go. He goes to Paris Saint-Germain. Okay. A year later, you know, they've had some time. So where are we now? So somehow, Barcelona's solution to being $500 billion in debt is to insist on their players either accepting pay cuts or even trades. Frankie de Jong is a talented Barcelona player right now. He has not taken a pay cut yet. A lot of the other players have. Barcelona has been desperate to trade him because they want to get his money off the books. And you know what? The guy likes living in Barcelona and he kind of doesn't want to go anywhere. And obviously, you know, when you realize, wow, they really don't want me here, okay, I'll go. But he doesn't want to leave. His family is there. You know, a lot of football players in Europe dream of going to either Barcelona or Madrid. So here you are. You're young. You're like, I think he's like 25 years old. He's got family. His dream is accomplished. And now his employer is insisting that he take a pay cut or that he accept a trade. Now, as you all know, when times are rolling, Imagine a player in the middle of the season telling Barcelona, imagine Frankie de Jong next year is like player of the year. And in the middle of the season, he's like, look, give me a raise now. They're not going to do it. They're not even going to talk about it to him. They're going to make him wait. They're going to make him prove he can do it for the whole season. And then they're still going to look at, well, we have other considerations to keep in mind. But when it's the institution that is in debt, just like you see in this country, when it's the airlines, when it's the banks, when it's, you know, all these institutions, if they're in debt, bailout. If you're in debt, oh, nothing is more expensive or more stressful than being poor in this country. And here you have a team across the pond, $500 billion in debt. And what has Barcelona done? They also have been doing what they call activating levers, which basically means selling media rights and future media rights and other kinds of institutional assets to raise the funds now. So somehow, $500 billion in debt. Barcelona this summer alone, bringing in Robert Lewandowski from Bayern, who was, I believe, the leading goal scorer in Europe last year. They bring in Rafinha, a very talented player from Leeds, which is significant. Also, Hector Moreno, who they brought from Arsenal. Those are significant signings because although they're not on the level of Lewandowski, the English Premier League is light years ahead of all the other major European soccer leagues as far as revenues and money and salary. So that Barcelona could bring in basically the premier available goal scorer in Lewandowski, bring in Rafinha and Moreno, who are both compensated English players, Jules Koundé, who's from Sevilla. Even at the end of the transfer window, Barcelona is pushing for Bernardo Silva from Manchester City. They're in enormous debt. How are they allowed to act like this? They're allowed to act like this because Barcelona and Madrid are basically state-subsidized soccer teams. They have different arrangements from the rest of La Liga in terms of payments they get from media rights and things like that. They are basically backed up. They're subsidized by the Spanish government, which is really hilarious. It's not official, but whenever you hear someone from La Liga complaining about teams like Man City or Paris Saint-Germain or now Newcastle, and the gripe is, oh, these are oil-backed states, like these are national. Well, so are you. Just you're coming from, you know, your state backed from a colonial power, and their state backed from one of the places that you colonized. That's the only difference. Somehow there's a world where Barcelona is getting away with behavior that would sink 95% of the teams in the world. And you will still hear a tenth of amount of coverage of this story as you will about any of the next petrol-backed teams either making a big move or having some kind of a debt. Watch and you will see. Guarantee it. And now I believe this is probably the first time this in the history of this show that we have gotten into college volleyball. But there's a specific reason, and I think it's a good story to be aware of if you haven't heard of it. Recently, Duke women's volleyball was playing at BYU. And Duke has a volleyball player named Rachel Richardson, who I think is the only black player on the team. When Duke was playing at BYU, Richardson was targeted by someone in the crowd, she says, with racist abuse and threats of physical violence. Let's remember at the start of the story that we're talking about a college student. Rachel Richardson is a volleyball player. Yes, she goes to Duke. But these are usually teenage kids, maybe 20. And this teenager, maybe 20-year-old, is getting racist slurs and threats of physical violence levied at her. Here's some of the response after all this has happened. And Richardson, after the game, says that this is what happened to her, and she was surprised that it was allowed to keep happening. So here you have a moment where a young black woman is raising accusations of disgusting treatment. And the institution has an opportunity to either respond to her and try to make amends with her, or try to protect their own ass? What do you think happened? So, first we have from athletic director, what's his name? The BYU athletic director said that he got all into trying to highlight and counter every detail that came out of the story. So one of the things that came out after the story was that Richardson, the student, was supposed to meet with BYU officials, including the head coach of the BYU women's team. She says the BYU women's coach never showed up. That's not really the point of the story. That's not really what it's all about. But BYU's athletic director is bringing up, oh, well, that actually never happened. She was never actually asked to be in the meeting. Why would she have to be asked to be in that meeting, by the way? Why would a 20-year-old, 19-year-old, however old she is, have to ask your school and your program and your like top officials for the coach to be there? How is that not common sense? How does the coach themselves not want to be there? If you believe, which is what a lot of the reaction has been out of BYU, they haven't said like, oh, she's right, we're sorry, and here's what we'll do to make sure this never happens again. A lot of the crap coming out of them has been, well, no one actually heard. I mean, we didn't hear it, and no one heard. So if you know in particular that, wow, someone is claiming to have had a really traumatic experience here, and we're not even aware that it happened, all your people should want to be involved, should voluntarily be involved in talking to the student, trying to be there for the student. Because remember, the reason BYU exists is not because of volleyball, it's because of students. They could talk to the student, they could work to make amends with the student, they could listen to recommendations from the student, or they can get nitpicky about, well, the coach wasn't actually asked by Duke or Rachel to be there. They shouldn't have to ask. It's embarrassing as a grown-ass adult that you're going to basically throw a child under the bus for not making all the requests that you think she should after what was probably a first-in-a-lifetime experience for her. There's a little victim blaming going on there, and it's gross. The director also said, and I love when this comes out, quote, "This is personal for me. It is personal because of my interaction with Rachel. It is also personal because of the many BYU coaches, athletes, staff, and students who are people of color." Okay. I'm just trying to pull up his name now, because if I'm going to keep talking about what he said, I really do feel I should have the man's name. Sorry, just give me 1 second. I know dead radio time is like the worst sin on earth, but I do want you to know this person's name. Here we go. Is it Tom Halmo? Yes, Tom Halmo is BYU's athletic director, Holmoe. So Tom Halmo says, "This is personal for me. It's personal because of my interaction with Rachel. It is also personal because of the many BYU coaches, athletes, staff, and students who are people of color. This feels to me precisely like whenever there is any kind of misogyny or sexual violence against a woman, and some man in the media will say that he cares about this because he has a wife, or he has daughters, or he has a sister, or he has a mother. It doesn't matter that BYU, like, it's disgusting because of what happened to Rachel Richardson. It's disgusting because it continues a tradition that has literally existed for like half a millennia on this continent. It doesn't matter how many coaches, athletes, staff, and students happen to be people of color at BYU. It could be zero. You should care for other reasons. Just like when you say, I have a wife, a daughter. No, you can have 2 dads and 12 brothers. That doesn't exempt you from having basic civility and empathy and care for someone who's different than you? Why do you have to know someone like them to make the connection that they're human? Again, all this happening to a college student, and the reaction from the institution where it happened is to cover their own ass. This from Joel Campbell, who is an associate professor in BYU's School of Communications. This was a humdinger. Quote, whatever the reality, I vehemently beg to differ with those who say that BYU continues to foster and harbor racists and racist ideologies. Across campus, there are diversity and inclusion committees who have attempted to change culture and root out racism. There are countless efforts to make BYU more inclusive. There's not enough to list all of them here. People need to seek the truth, but more importantly, we need to end this kind of polarization based on extreme views and give people the benefit of the doubt. Whatever happens to listening and understanding rather than jumping to conclusions without complete information? That is what Associate Professor in Communications at BYU, Joel Campbell, has to say. Okay, he doesn't vehemently come out against what happened to Richardson. He vehemently, in fact, he says whatever the reality, which is already placing a condition on her claim. It's like, well, I don't know if that happened because none of the all-white people around complained about it. So, quote, whatever the reality, you're already dismissing her claims. I vehemently beg to differ. That's what you're vehement about, not what happened, but about that people are making the not unreasonable connection. Oh, BYU's in Utah. When I think of Utah, I think of racism. That doesn't mean every single person in Utah is racist. It doesn't even mean that Utah is more racist than New York, Massachusetts, anywhere else you want to think of. But the point is, it's not better than anywhere else either. Like, if you accept that racism exists everywhere, and you accept that it's probably not better or worse anywhere, it's certainly probably not better in a state that has less diversity. If you accept that, why are you vehement about that point and not about, you know, I vehemently stand with Rachel Richardson and, you know, think of a gesture or something that could be done to show progressive action moving forward? What kind of action could you take that's literally like material and institutional and addresses the issue? Or you can vehemently beg to differ that BYU has racists. Then he says across camp, then his defense of this, this always is what you hear. Across campus, there are diversity and inclusion committees who have attempted to change culture and root out racism. You know what inclusion and diversity committees almost invariably do? They try to find ways to place minorities in white-dominated spaces. I challenge you to think of a single diversity and inclusion committee that has been focused on placing white people in non-white spaces, places of non-white public spaces. Diversity is always about pulling one group of people in one direction. That's not justice. That doesn't lead to people understanding each other. That leads to one group of people getting to remain the baseline and the comfortable. And it involves the groups that have historically been othered and oppressed have to come in and make sense of that new environment. And Joel Campbell is all bragging about committees. Then at the end, whatever happened to listening and understanding rather than jumping to conclusions without complete information? This is not a matter of civility. This is not a question of etiquette. This girl says that she was threatened with physical violence on top of the racist abuse that she got. And you think this is a problem that, on a rhetorical level, people don't listen as well as they used to? It's unbelievable. I chuckle at it because if I didn't chuckle at it, I really don't know what I would do. It's a grown-ass man basically telling a teenage girl, maybe a 20-year-old. He's telling someone who's not old enough to drink, probably, that this really isn't about her. If you don't laugh, I laughing's not the answer, but neither are these people. I've been feeling this way a lot about a lot of things in general. Like, I don't know what the answer is, but the answer is not the system in place now. The answer is not the people in place now. I don't know. I leave you with that. This hasn't been the most maybe uplifting Jacobin sports show ever, but those have been the stories going on in the world of sports recently that I thought were worth getting into. And hopefully you learned something today that you hadn't known, or at least thought something that you hadn't thought before. Borges said that one day all people would be capable of all thoughts. So today was our little contribution to that. So that is it for this episode of the Jacobin Sports Show. Again, please remember you can follow us on Twitter at Jacobin Sports. If you have not subscribed yet to our Patreon, I wish Jonah were here today because he could hear me pronounce it correctly for once. You can sign up at patreon.com/JacobinSportsShow. JACOBIN. And don't laugh because I got to tell you, like, until I started writing for Jacobin, I didn't know how to pronounce the word. All my friends who asked me about it pronounced it differently. I think I called it, was it Jacobin? I don't know. It wasn't Jacobin. So, Jacobin Sports Show. Twitter to find us there. Patreon to find us there. You can email us about the show at jacobinsports@gmail.com. That's all for this week. Please subscribe if you have not yet. And keep on listening. We will be back with another episode soon. Take care, everybody.